Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I bring people on who are part of this transition in the way we're thinking about the world and how we're moving into a new time, a new age, as it's been called, and how our whole idea of what the nature of reality is changing. So that's why I call this program New Realities. And my guest tonight is someone very much involved in this movement. He's just had the reissue of his book. Nothing in this book is true, but it's exactly how things are. Tonight's guest is Bob Frizzell. Bob, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I mean, when your book came out 15 years ago, it was such a catchy title, and of course, it was a book you couldn't forget. Of course, even if you didn't read it, you couldn't forget it because it was exactly, you know, as I got into this whole movement, let's say in the 80s and 90s, you would hear such outrageous things that it didn't quite fit into the nature of what the news was telling us on the television. And so I think that something like that probably inspired your book, right? Can you talk about that inspiration originally?
Boy, that's an interesting question. Actually, Alan, I guess the first point I need to make is that I was actively resisting writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
It first came to me about 1988, so that would have been about 6 years prior, when a rebirthing client of mine, after a series of sessions, you know, somewhere in the middle of a series of 10 sessions, revealed to me that not only she was an author, she hadn't told me that before, but she also told me that she was keeping a detailed diary of our sessions, and she pulled it out and showed it to me, and her whole motivation was to see if she could get me to co-author a book with her. And when I realized that we would simply be writing a proposal and from that try and find a publisher, I used that as my out. You know, I wasn't anywhere near 100% behind the project to begin with. I felt it would be too much work. Who am I? You know, nobody's ever heard of me, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if you want to read about rebirthing, find out what Leonard Orr has to say. That's kind of where I was at. And when I found that we didn't have a publisher, I just used that as my excuse, and I said no. And to myself, I said, I'm never going to write a book, in fact, unless a publisher comes to me and asks me to write a book. So, of course, I knew I was safe at that point. It lasted for about 4 years. One day in October of 1992, I got a call from a guy who saw my ad in one of the local papers. He wanted to come and find out about rebirthing. In fact, he came and scheduled a session. Rather interesting phone conversation in that we talked for about 45 minutes, and he was very different than most prospective clients because he was extremely skeptical. And I wasn't quite sure why he was calling in the first place, much less making an appointment. But he did, and he came. He didn't really believe me. He didn't really trust me. But in his session, he had an experience that it basically just flipped him over instantly. And he realized, you know, not conceptually, but experientially, that there was something really, really real here. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden our relationship was on firm footing. So at the end of the session, he had already told me that he was a publisher. In fact, when he came, he brought a copy of his company's catalog, and the cover was just filled with little pictures, each, you know, maybe 1 or 2 inch square like that. And the whole cover was just filled with that. And right in the very middle of that cover was a picture of the face on Mars, in the Cydonia region of Mars. And I just kind of gulped to myself, didn't say anything because we had work to do. But after the session was over, I asked him about that. And he told me that he was the publisher of Richard Hoagland's book, The Monuments on Mars. And you know, my interest was piqued because I had some pretty interesting ideas and theories about Cydonia, the face, and what it really represented and whatever. And I started asking him. Well, I had plenty of chances to ask him because he came for the next 30 weeks to do a session. So we developed a rather interesting relationship, and it was all centered around Mars. One day, I came home from my daily hike, and on the telephone, one of the messages was from this guy. The guy's name is Richard. And he asked me on this message if I would be willing to write a book. Yeah, my first response is, you got to be kidding, and there's no way. And then I realized what I had told myself 4 years earlier, and you know, I've been entertaining the thought for a long, long time, you know, since the late 70s, that there's much more to life than what appears, certainly than what Dan Rather or any other pundit is going to be telling you, and that, that you know, tuning into the higher aspects was, there was some real practical value in that. And I began to realize, oh, no. I can't say no to this because, you know, there's something going on here from higher levels. You know, I guess you could say that I subscribe to the idea that there really is no coincidence, that there's no accidents, and what happens is I couldn't skate my way out of this one, let's put it that way. So I had to say, yes, I'll write your book. And
So it was really an overview, I think, of all the spiritual movements that were happening in the 80s and into the 90s. It was kind of an overview of what was called the New Age at that point and has subsequently gotten a very bad name. If you call something New Age, I don't know why. I mean, it was good at the time. I guess it got a little dated. But, you know, all the things you talk about here are still relevant in a way. You know, they still affect people on some level. You know, Zachariah Sitchin, the legends of Atlantis and Lemuria, the Flower of Life. I mean, you really cover it. But when you say it's not true, is it not true because of the level of reality that we are functioning on in the day-to-day world? Is that what you mean?
Interesting question. The title is something that just came also. And in essence, it was just given to me. It just sort of came out of the blue. What I realized was, number one, it's a catchy title. And number two, I realized that it was the perfect disclaimer. So it gave me freedom to speak without, you know, trying to prove anything to the reader. It's just fine with me if you read the book sort of like a possibility or a science fiction book or, you know, something along those lines. And it's also just fine with me if you believe every word that's in there. But kind of because the information is so out there. It's such a leap, if you will, from our normal ways of perceiving reality, that I just felt that it was the perfect title, and well, actually still do.
Well, no, I totally agree with you, and that's sort of why I do this show, because how do we make the bridge? I mean, yes, your book is one way, but how do we make a bridge to making the relevance of all the things you talk about in here in a practical way to the people in the mundane world watching the football game on Sunday afternoon? In some ways, those people really don't care about the history of Atlantis or the Merkabah or whether the 12th planet seeded us from, you know, genetically mutated the primates that were living here. You know, and I think that's so fascinating and shows a level of truth that's possible, but I'm just saying, yeah, how do we make the bridge between those two parts of our cultural and intellectual understanding?
Well, I'm not sure we do directly. In fact, I'm pretty sure, I was going to say quite sure, but let me just say pretty sure that we don't. That what in fact we're going for here is a critical mass. And I guess you could say then the good news is that you don't have to reach 6.5 billion people in order to promote a profound change. You simply have to go for that critical mass, which is, who knows, somewhere.
144. It's 144,000, isn't that what people say?
Well, I would guess it's somewhere between 2-10% of the global population. And frankly, I think that in many ways we're already there, but I also think that what we're really doing is redefining just what critical mass means. So I'm not, even though I'll sit and watch the football game on Sunday too, I'm not necessarily preaching to your average fan.
Well, I know, but the interesting thing is, let's also talk about how much has changed since the first publication of this book 15 years ago.
Oh,
I mean, it seems like, you know, more and more people are talking about UFOs. It's a little more mainstream. It's still laughed at, but, you know, I'm talking about it all the time. I know the crop circles are real. I've been there. I was in England last year. It's like I stood in those circles, and no one could have made them on the ground as far as I was concerned. And there seems to be a little more of an awareness. Is that true, or is it just me?
Oh, I think you're absolutely onto something there. I first started hearing about this back in the late 80s and quickly realized that I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I lost friends over it. I was branded a kook, and I quickly learned that, you know, I better keep my mouth, or at least be very, very selective upon who I talk to. But now, 20 odd years later, it's enormous the ground we've covered. So absolutely, absolutely.
I know. I mean, that Hollywood picture of 2012, even though I didn't see it, it sounded like a real, you know, action kind of silly thing.
Your ultimate disaster flick. I didn't go there either. Don't plan.
But it's out there in the consciousness, and personally, and something I'm working for, in a sense, I think 2012 will be a palpable shift in the consciousness of the planet itself.
Oh, no doubt about it.
How do you see that happening?
Well, I see it happening perhaps a little bit differently than most people do. In the book, I lay an enormous amount of groundwork, giving what I've called the big picture, the big screen view, the big picture perspective on this. That, you know, if you're going to pick a starting point, we need to dispel a few myths here. One being that this is all there is. There's no other life out there. You know, come on. Hello. And another being that, how do I say it? We need to begin to realize that there are many, 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 almost an infinite number of different dimensional worlds out there. So not only is the universe teeming with life, but there are more different dimensional realities than if you live for a billion years, you wouldn't be able to count them all. So I lay that kind of groundwork and then also make the case for why these changes are happening now, all leading up to and including in this expanded version, in the new edition, information coming from the Hopis, from the Mayans. You know, everybody's looking to the Mayans because of the Mayan calendar in 2012 and what does that mean and all that. So basically, what I'm doing is laying the groundwork to get to the point to where we can really talk about this as a possibility. So,
so what do you think will happen? What's your, let's say, vision or prediction of that turning point, December 21st?
A good part of the groundwork that I lay in the book, Alan, is I have an entire chapter on history. I feel it's very important to lay this kind of groundwork because we tend to think that, history began about 3800 BC in Sumer, and before that, there was nothing but hairy barbarians, and certainly Atlantis, prior to that, Lemurian, whatever, didn't exist. And furthermore, this is the only dimensional level that the Earth exists on, et cetera, et cetera. So I do my best to break that one wide open. Mm. The other point with regard to the history is that in order for us really to understand what's happening now and what will happen in the future, we simply have to know the past. Mm. So the understanding of the past, what happened before, combined with what's so now, really, so we can have some sense of where we're going and what will happen. This is to me just real basic stuff. So I make the point that, and let me say that this is not something that I just pulled out of thin air. There are one of three enormously significant teachers in my life, a man by the name of Drunvalo. excuse me. A man by the name of Drunvalo Melchizedek appeared in my life in 1992 at absolutely the perfect time when I, in spite of all I had learned in the previous 12 years from Leonard Orr and through rebirthing, there was a part of me that was waking up to the possibility, not to the possibility, to the realization that there's missing information that I need to know about. One of the many things I had learned from Leonard was the power of 100% intention. Translated, what I mean is I didn't need to know what it was that I was seeking. I only needed to be able to be willing to play the game at 100%. And I knew that by being at 100%, that magic would begin to happen, that people literally would begin to crawl out of the woodwork with the information that I needed to keep me moving, to keep me on the path. Probably only see them for 5 minutes, but that's all that was necessary. It kept me going. Well, that process had been going on for a little less than a couple of years when magically I was introduced to this man, Drunvalo Melchizedek, realized about 5 minutes into his presentation that this is exactly what I was looking for. And interestingly enough, the bulk of his information comes from an ascended master that we know of as Thoth, a guy who has been around, allegedly alive and in a body for 52,000 years. You know, you could kind of say he's been there and done that.
Thoth is still in a body somewhere?
He left on May 4th, 1991. But,
Did he have a bird-like body? What kind of body did he leave and how do you know he left?
Okay. Well, we have to introduce the idea of ascended masters. And there's roughly about 7,000 or 8,000 of them. You could say that these are the 7,000 or 8,000 of us that have learned the rules of the game, learned how to keep their body beyond the normal lifespan, and realize the interconnection of all life everywhere. That if you look at it in spiritual terms, there's one spirit moving through all life, and if you look at it geometrically, you could say that everything in creation came through a single image. They understand that, and so
I totally agree with that, and I also think it's all our destiny to become that if we choose to and work through our human issues, but that's our destiny, is to become the ascended being.
I agree with that too. And so most of the ascended masters have moved on. They've been hanging out on the higher overtones, 10th, 11th, or 12th overtone of the sixth dimension. But there are a few who have decided to stay back. Perhaps Saint Germain is a very well-known one who has, for the most part, decided to stay back and play the game a bit differently.
And, right. And Babaji, you know, from India.
Yeah. Babaji is on a higher level even than the ascended masters, however, but another prime example. So Thoth is one of the few ascended masters who decided to stay back. Very simply, you know, at a certain point, compassion took him over. He realized, as above, so below. In fact, he's the one who said it. that he could be of more. He could be more useful simply by staying back here and participating more directly in our evolutionary process. So he did.
Well, why did he leave then, when we need him the most at this moment?
Well, even his leaving was compassionate. He said just prior to his leaving on May 4th, 1991, in essence, what he said is that we have reached a certain level of consciousness where it is absolutely certain that we will make it. And what I mean by making it is into the next level. That implies that really what my entire book is leading up to, that what these changes truly imply, the accelerated times that we're living in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that we're very much on the verge, very much in the process of moving from one dimensional aspect of this planet into a higher dimensional aspect, literally as though we're going back home.
I totally agree, and I think we're all feeling that, and the shift is what's shaking up the economy and countries and everything we know to be the old paradigm. It's all being shaken up to its roots.
Yes, it is.
But who told you that Thoth left? I mean, where'd you get the information about that?
This came from Drunvalo.
Came from Drunvalo. So we have to take Drunvalo's word for it. Not that it may or may not be true, but it's Drunvalo. Has Drunvalo met Thoth? Was he, were they acquainted?
Yes. Yes, he did, and yes, they were. For about a 7-year period, they had a communication going virtually on a daily basis. And so he had plenty of an opportunity to to get an expanded sense, you might say, of the rules of the game. And so this is how much of the information in my book came forth.
I'm just curious about the Thoth thing, because I always felt the connection to Thoth and Hermes and that whole alchemical tradition that I think Thoth probably began.
By the way, Hermes and Thoth are one and the same. He says the correct pronunciation, by the way, Alan, is Thoth, not Thoth. And I know.
Thoth.
Thoth. Thoth himself says that's my name.
Thoth himself said that's it. Did he channel Thoth, or was he like?
No, none of it was channeled.
How did he connect with Thoth?
Okay, well, this is we have to lay a little bit of groundwork to get who this guy Drunvalo is. And in his own words, he says that he's a walk-in.
I've interviewed them. Walk-in means that the old soul that was in that body left, so a new soul could come in.
There you go.
And lift it up to a higher vibration.
Yeah, and done with permission. It's not possession or anything like that. So Drunvalo claims that he walked into this body, his current body, on April 10th, I believe it was, 1972, and that in this process, at one point, he met Thoth. I mean, literally met him in the flesh. And that began this communication that lasted over a period of about 7 years.
What did Thoth look like? Did he look like an ibis from the Egyptian hieroglyphics, or did he look human?
Initially, his first appearance, which is the only description that Drunvalo ever gave of him, was that he had the appearance of about a 70-year-old man looking very Egyptian. He said he was also short, about 5'3", roughly, in height. And he described him. He said he was clean-shaven except for a beard hung down. It was tied in 5 knots. He wore very simple clothing. And this was in 1972, a meeting that was nonverbal, except at one point Thoth asked him, he told him there were he said there were 3 atoms missing in the universe and wondered if Drunvalo knew where they were.
How would Drumbolo know where they were?
Well, he's
oh, because he came from someplace else. So maybe that's how he may have known.
Immediately, he didn't, and he was going, duh, well, I don't really know what you mean, but he said that Thoth gave him an experience. And in that experience, he had an out-of-body experience. And when he came back from that experience, he says, "Well, I think this is what you mean." Thoth said nothing. He simply bowed and then disappeared. So that was
That's interesting. I think it was Drumbolo I met in 1987, and he was still working through an old kind of identity called Akbar. Do you know anything about that?
You are correct, yes.
I met him at the place in New Mexico, the Taos, what's that place up in the mountains of Taos?
Yes, Taos, New Mexico.
He was Akbar at that point. He looked a lot older, I have to say, than he does now, and that was, 20-something years ago.
Yeah.
So what
Akbar
happened to Akbar
Ali?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he was known as Akbar Ali at the time, and he was not allowed to use his name Drumbolo Melchizedek until the appropriate moment, and that happened to be about 1985.
Because I met him in 87, and it was only in 88 that he started to do the Merkaba breathing. That I remember,
Okay. Well, yeah, anyway, sometime around then, he was allowed to, for the first time, begin using his name, Drumbolo Melchizedek.
Oh, I see. So Akbar was a kind of a pseudonym?
Same guy.
Same soul.
Same body, same spirit in the body and all of that. He simply hadn't gotten to the Drumbolo part yet.
I see. I met him with Diana Gaze's originally.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Sure. He's talked about her.
No, it was great. No, it was great to meet him, and I remember that. And then I went to visit him later when he was living in Taos at that place he bought from Katerina Raphael, the dome. And he was just developing his workshops and transforming. He's been through quite his own transformation in this journey.
Yeah, he has. He definitely has. He has. He doesn't have the full memory of who he is or where he came from. In his own words, it would simply be too painful to be here in this dark, dense aspect of the reality. But he has a pretty expanded sense of who he is and how we fit into the grand picture or whatever. And frankly, he's served as a very, very useful teacher, truly a blessing in my life.
For a lot of people, he's been quite a ambassador of the new age bringing together the understanding of sacred geometry and the flower of life and transforming people's consciousness by this, meditation on these forms that activate the higher centers in the brain. So he's been quite a part of this transition time for a lot of people.
Yes, no doubt about it, and I couldn't agree more.
And so, in your book, you have all these elements, which we've all been studying, the sacred geometry, the UFOs, the Philadelphia experiment, all the crop circles. I mean, it's all a part of what I call new realities. I think at some point, though, we have to see how it's all going to come together. How are these separate things going to merge and awaken the higher embodiment of humanity?
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the sacred geometry. For starters, we can go there for a moment.
Yes.
The whole purpose of sacred geometry is to show the part of us that is deeply immersed in polarity, in separation, that there is only one creation image. There is one pattern through which the entire creation came through, one and only one pattern. If you put that in spiritual terms, there's one spirit and only one spirit moving through all life everywhere. Now, to get to the basics here for a moment, there is this part in us. You know, we have the left brain, right brain aspect in us. Our right brain, intuitive, feminine side, really doesn't have a problem with the unity of being. It can't explain it, but it's not interested in explaining. It's simply interested in living the experience. Mm-hmm. But the problem is our left brain, the logical male side of us. It looks out and it sees division and separation everywhere it looks. And furthermore, it gets no help from the one source that, you know, at least logically you would look to for some help, and that's religion. But when you look there, all you get is more separation and division. So it simply does not believe in the unity of being. Well, if you go back to ancient Egypt and prior to that in Atlantis, it was considered supremely important. So important, in fact, that they took 12 years in a mystery school to show the left brain and everyone that there is one and only one creation pattern, one and only one spirit moving through all life everywhere. And, you know, I guess after 12 years, it perhaps would be enough time for it to really sink in. But the point being that the left brain in us absolutely must be convinced. And it must be shown in the only way it can be shown, which is logically. And that's the perfect tool being sacred geometry. So in my book, I have two chapters that are devoted completely to sacred geometry. Again, not for the purpose of teaching sacred geometry, but really for the sole purpose of showing the doubter in us, the left brain, the unity of being.
Well, I mean, when you say there's the one creation pattern, what is that pattern?
Well, the flower of life. If you've never, well, everybody has seen the pattern, whether they're able to name it or not. If you're just looking at the flower of life superficially, what you're going to see is, I guess you're just going to see an interesting pattern. If you start to look at it a little more closely, you perhaps would start to count the interwoven circles. And if you do, you're going to get 19 circles. But if I were to sit here and tell you that contained in this image is absolutely everything in creation, you know, that it's the blueprint for all of creation, that everything, all the laws of physics, all biological life forms, absolutely everything without exception is contained in this image, you'd say I'm nuts.
Well, but I might.
But it nonetheless is an absolutely true statement. And so sacred geometry is, you know, depending on how deep you want to get into it, if you go deeply enough, you will come away absolutely convinced that contained in this pattern is all of creation.
I know, that's a big part of the book. But the other part, you also talk about the ETs and grays. And I wonder, I mean, how that fits into the sacred geometry, because they seem to be, at least from my research, functioning on a whole different level of reality that transcends this human experience.
Well, the Greys are a rather interesting race of beings in that they are supremely intelligent. However, they have no emotional body. I make the point in the book through what I call the Lucifer Rebellion that Lucifer is only the fourth very high being to attempt this. It's been attempted three times before where, well, just using the example of Lucifer, at one point was the top model of all the angels sitting right there on the left-hand side of God and for whatever reason deciding to create a separate reality. It's possible to do if you know the universal pattern of creation, the Merkaba field, which originally was intended to be created only as a living energy field, where you need both sides of the brain, left brain and right brain, the logical and also the emotional side working together to create this living energy field. But the fact is it can be created through technology also. And in order to do that, you don't need the right brain component. You simply need the left brain understanding. There is a limitation or a problem that goes with this, however, and that is that if you follow this to the nth degree, you get to a point where you have literally severed your right brain intuitive or love connection with all life everywhere, and the Greys are a supreme example of a race of beings that have done this. They've taken it about as far as you can go. They understand the reality, but only logically. They have no emotional component. They don't know.
They're here because they realize that that hit a dead end. And they're here to genetically extract from humans the physical, emotional component so they can start to thrive again. Because when you hit that dead end, you start to deteriorate. You start to go towards extinction because you're missing that love.
That is right? Correct. That yes. is correct. And in order to fully answer that question, you are correct in suggesting that the Greys have used a part of us and also a part of them literally to clone a brand new race. They have done that, and I detail that in the book. But there's a larger reason for why they have done that, and that has to do directly with the accelerated times that we're in and literally the dimensional shift that we're on the verge of experiencing.
And they also must be on the verge of experiencing the same dimensional shift, because they're not quite of our dimension, but it seems like it's a universal dimensional shift that we're all moving in sequence to a new vibrational way of being.
Yeah, something big time is going on here that we can't possibly get into it. I can only speak in vague generalities. I'll do my best to cover this, though. I build the case for and make the point in the book that we are very much in process of moving into what I'm calling either the 10th, 11th, or 12th overtone of the fourth dimension, given that we're sitting on the third dimension right now. Mm-hmm. So we're very much in process of moving into a higher, much, much higher vibratory rate world, a much shorter wavelength world, where if a fourth dimensional being were to appear here, he or she simply would be able to walk through the wall. So mm-hmm. we will be in light bodies at that point. But even though I can't get into it, I can just kind of throw it out there that something much, much bigger is going on than that. And for whatever reason, this little speck of dust in the middle of nowhere called planet Earth seems to be the center for all of this. Mm. That not only are we about to go into the fourth dimension, but higher life forms, ascended masters, Melchizedeks, and forms even higher than that are telling us that they strongly suspect that this entire octave of 144 dimensional universes is in process of shifting into the next octave. Well, that directly addresses, if this is true, the problem that the Greys and other total left brain cultures are having, because there is a void that separates each dimensional level. Mm. But there is a huge wall of voidness that separates the octaves. See, there's 144 different dimensions in each octave. You cross through this huge wall of voidness into the next octave, and there's 144 different dimensional worlds there. But the problem is, you can't get through the great wall of voidness from one octave to the next taking anything with you. You cannot bring your technology through, and that's all they know. So you can travel interdimensionally in your UFOs. It's what we call an external Merkaba field created through technology. You can also do it in a living energy field, in a living alive Merkaba field,
by activating yourself with your own, you know, higher dimensional facilities through the brain consciousness mind mechanism, right?
Yeah, and the most important component is the heart. You must mm-hmm. feel the interconnection that you have to all life everywhere. Unconditional love is the bottom line here. And the Greys can't do that. But the biggest problem for them and other left brain cultures is, if it's really true that the octave is about to shift up, you can't take any technology through the Great Wall into the next octave. And so they can't do it. So from their perspective, they're a dying race, and they know it. That's why they came here, to use part of us.
Heart and feeling sense to help shift them to the next reality.
There you go. Knowing that they can't make it themselves, but they are cloning experts. And so they have already, and successfully, I might add, created or cloned this new race.
And I'm a part of that. I've given my genetics to that, I feel. At least that's what I feel. But, you know, I think my theory is that we are actually, and I'm going to talk about this on Friday. I'm doing a little lecture with my friend Julia Mick. And on 2012, in this time of transition, because I think we're actually living in the fourth dimension. This is how I understand it, because we are emotional beings. The third dimension is the world of plants and animals and earth and all that. But the reality we live in is very much an emotional reality. And that's what I call the fourth dimension. And where we're moving into the fifth dimension is these higher consciousness awarenesses of these psychic intuitions and these like higher visionary states. That's what I call the fifth dimension. I mean, yeah, there may be all these other levels, 144, but I think, does that make sense to you, that we're already beyond the third dimension in an emotional level? Yeah.
Sure does. I'm giving a strict a definition, if you will, of dimensions. Yeah. In fact, I have I've devoted a chapter to it in the book, where I'm simply talking about different wavelength universes, that in fact wavelength is the key to everything. Mm-hmm. And we're very much in process of moving into a shorter wavelength, much, much higher vibratory rate universe. And then it's simply a question of, you know, how you want to number it, define it, or whatever. But I hear what you're saying about third and fifth dimensions, and I absolutely agree.
Well, but I liked what you said there, is that there seems to be a doorway that will close, that you can't take your technology with you. And this is why the grays are so present at this for the last probably 100 years or so in these genetic experiments, because they know right now, they sense the future, and they know it's the time of transition. And do you think 2012 then is that point?
Well, not necessarily. That's a whole another question. I mean, it's been interpreted that way for quite some time. But if you start taking a look at some of these, what I call end time prophecies, a very interesting picture begins to reveal itself. And for example, I talk about the Hopi prophecies in the book, and make the point that the Hopis, along with the Mayans, are both saying that their 200-year-old prophecy has been fulfilled. That, in fact, on October 24th of 2007, there's a comet, to be technical, comet 17P/Holmes, blew up in our solar system. And in the process of blowing up, by mid-November, this comet became, for a brief period of time, the largest object in our solar system, bigger even than the sun. Well,
Yes, that was really weird, and it wasn't really covered by mainstream science.
Yeah, they're not going to go there. But the point being that this exploding blue star, according to the Hopis and the Mayans themselves, is the fulfillment of their 200-year-old prophecy. Should make the point here that the Hopis actually are Mayans. They say this themselves, that they came at one point, you know, I'm not sure when, they simply migrated north until they landed in Arizona, but they're Mayans and they know it.
I never heard that before. Is that another Drumvalo thing? Where'd you get that? Because I never heard.
I first got that, I think, from Drumvalo. Yeah.
Interesting. I know he's also working with the Kogis in South America that are now getting much more public, and there's actually a Kogi journey happening in January that a friend of mine, Barbara Three Crow, is going on to the sacred sites of the Sierra Nevadas in Colombia to activate these portals to bring in, I feel, probably more higher energy frequencies to the Earth itself.
Mm-hmm. Good. Back to this Hopi prophecy thing, Alan. What they're saying then is that beginning on October 24th, 2007, what this did was it opened up a window that is approximately 7 years in duration, meaning that if the prophecy is correct, sometime between 2007, October 24th, and say roughly about 2015, if they're correct, then we very likely are to experience changes almost greater than our ability to imagine, where we will literally shift dimensional realities. So they also go on to say that the exact date almost certainly will not be December 21st, 2012. Rather, it'll happen sometime in that seven-year window.
I see. So December 21st, 2012, though, is an alignment of the Earth, the Sun, and the center of the galaxy, which I feel will have some kind of a consciousness effect.
Well, it's also the point in a 26,000-year cycle called the precession of the equinoxes, where we make the turn, so to speak, and start moving into the awake cycle of this precession. 26,000 years in duration, half the time, 13,000 years, were in the asleep cycle, the other half were in the awake cycle. December 21st, 2012 is the exact moment that we turn the corner and start moving into the awake cycle.
Who says that? Is that the Mayans who say that?
Oh, yeah. I think that the precession perhaps has been researched by the Hindus and Tibetans perhaps more than anyone. I talk about it in my book, so I give what I can give you in there. But we should perhaps cover a bit more ground on this Hopi prophecy thing, and to explore the idea that the Hopis and the Mayans are one, just a little bit more.
Yeah.
The Mayans are conscious survivors of Atlantis, and meaning that most everybody, if they survived the sinking of Atlantis and all that went with that, if they survived that 13,000 years ago, everybody, with the exception of the Ascended Masters and the Mayans, had their memories completely erased, you know,
what
back
about
to square one.
What about the Egyptians, and what about the, the Platonic dialogues that mention Atlantis? I mean, I think the Egyptians had some memory, but maybe that was actually lost over time.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we can cover all these bases,
okay.
but
let's go back to the Mayans. Okay, the Mayans remembered that they were Atlanteans. Okay.
Yeah, they were conscious survivors. The reason they were conscious survivors is they remembered the Merkaba. They were able to keep the energy field around their body alive, which you absolutely need when you're traveling from one dimensional world to another. In the absence of the either living or synthetic Merkaba field, your memories will be completely erased. So they remember not only the last time 13,000 years ago we went through a dimensional shift, but also prior to that 26,000 years ago. So they say they hold the memory of the last two dimensional shifts. And if this is true, perhaps they are worth listening to. They also go on to say that basically for the past 13,000 years, we moved out of the heart, which is where we were in Atlantis, and prior to that in Lemuria, we were living in the heart, which only knows unity. And when we went through dimensional free fall 13,000 years ago and landed down in this dark, dense aspect of the reality that we call the third dimension, we moved from the heart and into the mind. The distinction being the heart only knows unity, the mind only knows polarity. So a very simple way of looking at this dimensional shift is that we're very much in process of moving back out of the mind and back into the heart, i.e. back into unity.
Mm, I like that. That makes a lot of sense. So, so the Hopis are now more conscious survivors of the Mayan legacy. Is that what the Hopis are?
The Hopi and the Mayans are one.
But the Hopis have seemed to kept alive their prophecies, and the Mayans actually. Well, we've had to extract it from the Mayans, but I don't know. There seems to be something the Hopis are doing that are different than the Mayans. Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another point here, and that is that from everything that we've seen from the Mayans in roughly the last 500 years, 527 years, I think, to be exact, they say that none of it came from them. Now, actually, the Hopis say the same thing, but the Mayans go on to say that this is about to change, that they are very much in process of giving their version of events, and in so doing, literally enlightening the world as to, if it's really true that they've got the memory of the last 26,000 years, I kind of feel that when they speak, I'm going to listen.
Wait, what? None of what came from them, and none of the history that we know came from them? Which part didn't come from them?
Everything that's been written about the Mayans, they say none of it in the past 527 years has come from them.
I see, but still it's true on some level because they are saying it's a fulfillment of their prophecy, right?
Well, my understanding of that, Alan, is that the best you can say is that we're dealing, when you're looking at anything written, then the Mayans said this, said that, let's be clear, they say they didn't say it, at the best you can say is you're dealing with partial information. So, well-minding, well-intending people doing their best to put the Mayan information out there, probably not realizing themselves that they're only dealing with partial information. So the Mayans say that it's time that we knew, and they're about to come forth. They say.
Where will we hear them coming forth?
Well, all right. There's I believe the number is 440 Mayan elders, and so they are going to come together. Now, realize that logistically speaking, they're not able to rent a 5-star hotel or anything like that. So just getting them all together is a huge deal. But they say that they're going to do it, and when they do, they say that they have the memory of the past 26,000 years contained in, I believe the number is 13 crystal skulls. Now, we're starting to get into some Indiana Jones type stuff here, but...
Well, I've seen the crystal skull, and actually I'm planning on having a forum where we'll bring at least 10 crystal skulls together in New York, maybe in connection with the UN, on 10-10-10, October 10th, 2010.
Great.
So what do they say about bringing these crystal skulls together?
They say that the memory of the last 26,000 years, as the Mayans know it, is contained in these crystal skulls.
Wow, that's very... Is that in your book? I didn't see that. Is that in the book?
No, I didn't go quite that far. I don't think I mentioned the crystal skulls there, but that to me is just flat out awesome. If this is real...
I would rent a hotel ballroom for this. I'm sure a lot of people would. So I think they should gather, or we should. I'd go down there with a television camera and document the 144 Mayans coming together with 13 crystal skulls.
Yeah, 440, I think, is the exact number.
Whatever. But, yeah, that's very exciting.
Yes, it is. Well, these are exciting times, but you've got to get the big picture. If you know nothing more than the 2012 movie that Hollywood just put out, it's just not going to take you where you need to go.
Right. No, this is all very exciting. Is there anything that you didn't put in the book that was just too out there for you?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably.
Because you weave a nice picture with all the elements that have come together, but is there something that you just couldn't fit in that was part of that
I'm not getting anything at the moment.
All right, so great.
Probably the 13 crystal skulls. I don't know.
No. But I'm just wondering what's too way out for you, because, you know, I've heard it all too, and it's like we're all trying to make sense of all this. So anyway, you know, it's been really fascinating. Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. It's bobfrizzell.com, and you can go there and see the workshops I give. By the way, I'm giving my Flower of Life workshop in New York City in June, 25th to the 27th, and I'm really excited about that.
Oh, that's right. You're doing a book signing at East West Books, which
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah. What's the dates again in New York?
Well, the workshop, The Flower of Life, is June 25th through the 27th. The book signing at East West, I believe, is Thursday, June 24th. And so that's all on my website. You can get my book on my website, too. And there's, you know, probably for many of your listeners, that's the next step to take. You know, go to my website, check it out, and see what you find there. And if you like it, buy the book.
Thank you, Bob. It's been a great conversation. I've enjoyed it. I'm talking to Bob Frizzell. Nothing in this book is true, but it's exactly how things are, and I suppose that's true, as they are that way.
Yeah, well, it is or it isn't. Alan, I supremely enjoyed our conversation, too, and I really, really do want to thank you for having me on. I greatly appreciate it, so thank you.
You're welcome, and maybe we'll do it again before you come in June.
Love to.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. I've been talking to Bob Frizzell. If you want to reach me, I'm at newrealities@earthlink.net. Check my website, newrealities.com. And thank you for listening.